News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next.
Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show. I'm Gregory Berg. We talk today about remaining young. And the topic is of great importance to just about all of us in various ways. And it is explored in most intriguing fashion in a brand new book called You, Staying Young, The Owner's Manual for Looking Good and Feeling Great. The book is co-authored by two doctors, Mehmet C. Oz, Dr. Oz, who is well known for his work on television, and one of his friends and colleagues, my morning show guest today, Dr. Michael F. Roizen, who is a best-selling author and co-founder of a popular website called RealAge.com. He is chief wellness officer and chair of the Wellness Institute of the Cleveland Clinic, and he is the chief medical consultant to the Dr. Oz show. And this book, published by Simon & Schuster, is just the latest in several collaborations between these two well-known and highly regarded doctors. Again, this newest book called You, Staying Young, The Owner's Manual for Looking Good and Feeling Great. Dr. Michael Roizen, we welcome you to the morning show.
It's a privilege to be here. Thank you very much.
I'm excited to talk with you. And
Greg, the excitement is mine, so thank you.
The book really sets this whole topic in very healthy context, I think. That is, it's a good way for us to be thinking about this, and it brings into question some of the assumptions which a lot of us make. And one of them is this, that living longer is not the point. And, of course, you very carefully titled the book Staying Young. But at one point in the introduction, you say living longer should not be about taking longer to die. It should be about enjoying every moment of a longer life and taking longer to live. Obviously, that's a distinction that is very, very important to you and your co-author.
That's exactly right. The point of this is, if you will, the idea behind it is that you can live vibrantly till real near the end and then essentially get struck by lightning and die. And that's what most of us want to do, that is to live vibrantly and without frailty. And that's really a key. So if we eliminated all heart disease and all cancer, we might live 8 years longer. But if we eliminated frailty, you'd live 60 or 70 years longer. And that's and with vibrancy. And that's really the key, is how do you eliminate that frailty, and what do you do, and how easy is it to do it? So there are a lot of what we do, I mean, where there's science in the book, there's also a lot of action steps so people can understand both the science and then know what to do. And it's pretty easy things, what to do to change your rate of aging so that you stay vibrant. Now, one of the key points in science is you develop defects in yourself, in your cells, threefold greater every 10 years. So if you decrease your rate of aging by 10 years, you're essentially got threefold less defects in your cells. If you do it by 20 years, you got tenfold, three times three, so you get ninefold less errors. And so the key is slowing aging just by 20 years means that you are much more vibrant, much less likely to be frail as you do get older in calendar years.
One of the most surprising moments in the book, I think, but also a moment which is potentially of great help in helping us think about this, in a sense, more holistically, is when you and Dr. Oz liken the human body to a city. Why is it helpful for us to think about our human body, our own body, and our sort of own personal physical health as something like a city? In what way is that model helpful and beneficial?
Well, the analogy lets people understand what it is. So you're, and let me give you some of the ideas. So a city can become old. Some of the European cities have become old and inelegant, whereas some cities that are old rejuvenate themselves, repair themselves, redesign themselves, such as Paris, and it's gorgeous, it's beautiful. And the analogy works in another way. San Francisco is built on earthquake faults. That's its genes, if you will. But whether it has a crisis for every sixth earthquake or not depends on what the citizens have done, what the regulations are, how they've treated their city so that it doesn't have every piece of building falls apart. They've learned how to build with architecture that can withstand sixes and maybe even sevens and maybe even eights of earthquakes. So the geography is your genes, but you get to change them. You get to know whether they will be affected or not by the way you act, by the way you make choices that influence your genes.
Hmm. That's a really fascinating insight which you offer, that because I think most of us think of our genetic makeup and our genetic predisposition as something entirely out of our own control. But you contend that there are actually steps that people can take, and probably as medical science continues to advance, there's going to be more and more which we can even do about our own health, even at that level of genetic predisposition, which is really an amazing thing to think about.
Yeah, the real key, you know, probably the most important study that has been done since 2000, since we were able to characterize that we have a genome and what it is one that you get to take action steps for and that we talk about in the book, which is the ENCODE study. And you don't have to remember the name at all. But what we know is that about 10 to 20% of your total DNA is genes. And so what people thought the other 80 to 90% was junk. They called it junk DNA. But it isn't junk. It switches, and that's what the ENCODE study group found. It is switches that control your genes. So all your genes do is they're protein factories. But whether that factory is on or not is controlled by these switches. And it turns out your actions and your choices to a huge degree control those 22 to 30,000 genes by either turning them on or off. And let me give you a specific example. When you are stressed, you turn on 548, we know the exact number. You make them active producing proteins when you're stressed, genes that produce things that cause inflammation in your body. So there are 548 different proteins that are released when you get stressed. But if you manage that response so you aren't stressed, so the same event occurs, but now you have managed it so you don't get a stress response to it, none of those genes turns on. So you don't have the inflammation in your body. So you get to control, you literally get to control what's going on in your body.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Michael Roizen, and we are talking about the book which he has co-authored with Dr. Mehmet Oz, You, Staying Young, The Owner's Manual for Looking Good and Feeling Great. Before we get into a few of the specifics in terms of how this book is put together, I certainly want you to have a chance to talk through the principles of longevity, which are part of the introduction, which I think are so helpful for anybody who wants to kind of think about the whole notion of what well-being is all about and what a long life at its best really entails. Explain, first of all, about how the process of aging, which of course is in an inevitable process, is involved in a whole lot of trade-offs. And what kind of good trade-offs do we need to be prepared to make?
Well, so we think of, if you will, aging as, if you will, creaky joints and constipation and bowels that don't work, et cetera. And you live to 80-something, and then in exchange you're going to have your fair share of misery. Well, that isn't the right trade-off. The right trade-off is, in fact, the reason that we get to over 30 and then develop problems is all our genes care about is that we reproduce. And we reproduce usually and largely and have for all of our history before the age of 30. So what makes sense for reproduction doesn't necessarily make sense for longevity. So, for example, when you go in a famine, you shut down your reproductive cells so that you don't produce a child during a time when they couldn't get the right nourishment. Makes total sense for this. You're shutting down processes. But when you go in a famine and you're old, as we talked about with calorie restriction, you in fact get to kill cells that are not going to survive. And when you're doing the refeeding, you actually produce more stem cells that then can repair damage. So the trade-off, what doesn't make sense for reproduction makes perfect sense for old age and vice versa.
Hmm.
And so those are the trade-offs that we talk about. Aging isn't some master plan for your life, but rather an offshoot of perpetuation of the species.
Right. And of course, you've just touched on your second principle, which is that the aging process is not so much about things breaking down as what is your body's capacity to repair, to recover. And of course, we can do all kinds of things to enhance that. Let's talk about the third principle, which is where you say aging happens from both the inside out and the outside in. I'm so glad you said this because I think you're absolutely right that most of us think of aging as a somewhat sort of mysterious process, even though it's something we all experience, but that it's something completely sort of intangible and not within our grasp to even understand, let alone affect. Tell us more about this model of inside out and outside in, why this is important.
It goes with what we were talking about, the question you asked before, Greg, that was so insightful, which was that you get to control it. So it is simple things like putting on sunblock protects you from the outside. But in addition, your arteries, which nourish your skin, are from the inside of you. And they, by nourishing your skin, prevent wrinkles, so you don't look that way. But in the bigger sense of the word, it is really about your rate of aging. So we double our rate of aging, as I said, about every 7.5 to 8 years, or we have threefold as many errors 10 years from now as we have now. Well, if you can stop that, if you can slow that by 20 years over your lifetime, which is really quite doable, you actually at age 80 function like you're 60 or with much less frailty. And so the goal, in fact, is to keep extending that. And so all of these areas, there are the 14 areas in here, which we talk about where there's really enormous research into mechanism to slow that, all of this is in fact relating to the repair mechanisms and being able to send in new stem cells which will repair the damage and replace it with new cells. So if you have a heart attack, rather than that part of the heart dying and there'd be no retrieve and you just don't function very well and don't pump blood very well. In fact, you send in new stem cells which replace the old cells and you come back to pumping your blood normally and having the energy and vitality of someone who didn't have any damage in the first place.
Hmm. I appreciate that your fourth principle touches on what is such a frustrating reality for a lot of people who are aging, namely the fact that it is so often a compounding of problems, one problem that affects another problem, that aggravates another problem, that sets all kinds of things in motion, and the fact that even treating a given problem will sometimes aggravate another problem or create one that didn't exist. And it's important for us to understand this because this is also a reality which, at least to an extent, we can prevent.
Right. So people often call this the Swiss cheese theory of aging, or the Swiss cheese effects. So if you line up all the holes in Swiss cheese, that's when you get aging. But if, as long as they're in random order and you can't get through with errors, then you don't develop the aging phenomenon. So the goal is to have more of these layers of protection, more of the slices of Swiss cheese that don't allow the errors to come through, so that the healthier you are, the more you do physical activity that is appropriate for those four components, 10,000 steps a day, 20 minutes of resistance training twice a week, jumping 40 times a day, and doing a little cardio 20 minutes three times a week. As long as you do that, you're much more protected against other injuries from bad food or against inflammatory processes or against other causes of injury. So, and the same thing, in other words, if you do the right stress practices, if you avoid toxins, if you do the right physical activity practices, if you choose foods that are anti-inflammatory, all of those things prevent the next layer of going down, so you avoid hitting the holes in the Swiss cheese, or you keep healthier longer.
Hmm. And the final of these five principles is sort of the summation of all that we've talked about thus far. Aging is reversible. That is, even if you are looking back at certain choices you've made that were not the right choices when it comes to physical well-being, that it is never too late to, at least to some extent, halt that decline and maybe reverse the process of aging at least a bit.
That's exactly right, Greg. So we routinely take people who have type 2 diabetes and get them to reverse it. So there's 60 to 70% of us have the genes for type 2 diabetes. And whether we develop it is often brought on by environmental factors such as how we eat and exercise, et cetera. Well, just as easily as we can bring it on, we can reverse it. Same goes for high blood pressure. Same goes for plaque in our arteries. You get to pull it out if you want to. And that's really one of the keys. Aging may be inevitable, but the rate of aging isn't. And you get to reverse it if you want. All you need is that nudge to do so and to actually take action.
Speaking of that, let's talk about some of the important components that are that form the framework of this book. Again, we're talking about you staying young, and I'm speaking with its co-author, Michael Roizen, Dr. Roizen. In just about every chapter, one of the features is major agers. And I guess this is where we look at factors in our lives that are contributing to the aging process.
That's right. The way we organized the book was to have a major ager and then to talk about some of the ways you can deal with those. So, for example, when we talk about toxins, we talk about canceling out cancer and also breathing easy. Breathing easy obviously involves how you avoid the toxins in the air, and cancel out cancer is the toxins that you might get in food or other places. Another major ager is glycosylation, putting an excess glucose on your oxygen, and then we talk about how you can avoid, if you will, the complications of type 2 diabetes. So all of these, there are 14 major ages where there are major research now going into the aging processes. And if we have any a breakthrough in any of these 14, you will live, you will be able to live to be 160 with a quality of life of 45. And as I said, we're on our way, especially in this periodic fast, to maybe getting a key insight into how we can do that. As you know, the jellyfish lives forever by, when it gets enough injury, it goes back and just starts all over again, regenerating itself from its own stem cells. Well, we know that if we keep enough stem cells, we can repair any injury. And so that's really a key. So you get a muscle injury, you send in your stem cells, which repair it and become muscle cells. You get a heart attack, if you've got enough stem cells, they go in there and repair that and become those heart muscle cells. So we know that the key is close to a breakthrough, and that periodic fast of 5 days where you both turn on sirtuin, which helps slow your rate of aging, but you also turn on your stem cell production and your telomeres and your stem cells, so you regenerate stem cells with that. So anyway, what we do is we go through the 14 areas, the latest research, and then all the steps that we know that you can take now that make a difference in your rate of aging now until that major breakthrough occurs. Now, you can say, well, what's the chance of a major breakthrough? Well, Google, the lead scientist at Google, is now working hard on human longevity. That's where they've put him, and he believes that it's more likely than not by 2030 we will have a breakthrough. Now, who is he? It's Ray Kurzweil, who is the guy who predicted to the day when the big blue IBM computer would beat the chess champion Kasparov. And he's the guy who's worked a lot on Moore's Law and on the change in solar rate of adoption of solar panels, et cetera. But he's had a tremendous series of correct predictions. And he says there's enough interest and investment in aging research that one of these areas is likely to be have a major breakthrough by 2030.
Hmm.
So it's imperative, or it's beneficial for you. If you're going to live past 2030, you might as well be as young as you can be at 2030, so you can stay that way for the rest of your life when that major breakthrough occurs.
A lot of intriguing information here, and every chapter also giving us tests we can take to sort of assess our own process of aging, tips on what to do better, tools to work towards our own well-being. A most valuable book, again, called You Staying Young, The Owner's Manual for Looking Good and Feeling Great, published by Scribner, a division of Simon & Schuster. And Dr. Michael Roizen, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. It was great to talk to you.
You're wonderful. Thank you. Great question.
The time is 8:33, and you're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. Here's part two. We're spending the next few minutes here of WGTD's Morning Show talking with a very intriguing woman by the name of Lauren Rutolo, the author of a book called Unstoppable in Stilettos, A Girl's Guide to Living Tall in a Small World. It is a very intriguing book that is also kind of an inspiring guide to going after your dreams and not letting certain problems along the way or certain restrictions get in your way at all. And certainly Lauren Rutolo has managed to do that. She is director of entertainment promotions at Hearst Magazines in New York City. And she has achieved her great success despite the fact, and maybe also partly in concert with the fact, that she was born with something called McCune-Albright syndrome, a very, very rare genetic disease, which typically leaves people wheelchair-bound for all of their lives. My word, that has not happened even a little bit to Lauren Rutolo. She is living a very, very big life. despite this encumbrance on her health. And she wants her story to be inspiration to really all of the rest of us, even if we aren't contending with the specific things that she is. The book, again, is called Unstoppable in Stilettos, A Girl's Guide to Living Tall in a Small World. It's published by Health Communications Incorporated. And Lauren Rutolo, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, good morning to you.
Looking forward to talking with you. You say very early in the introduction, life should be lived large every day. And you have managed to do that despite the fact that you live with this thing called McCune-Albright syndrome. At the risk of allowing this to define you, which I know we don't want to do, we really probably should start there. Explain to our listeners what McCune-Albright syndrome is and the way in which this has very powerfully affected your life.
Well, sure. McCune-Albright syndrome is a genetic disease that affects your, in women, it's mainly a women's disease, and it affects your skeletal and your endocrine system. When speaking about the hormonal, which is your endocrine system, what happens is that your ovaries and your pituitary gland work independently of each other, which means that at 9 months old, I got my period, which is something that the average girl does not get till, you know, anywhere from 11 to 15. So they diagnosed me immediately with precocious puberty. And then about 9 to 11 months later, I was walking in a store with my father and I broke my hip. Mm. And the combination of the two, they diagnosed me with McCune-Albright syndrome.
This is something which evidently is quite rare.
Yeah, it's called an orphan disease, which means that anyone from 1 in 100,000 to 1 in 1,000,000 people have it.
Hmm. Can you just say a word more about how you dealt with this as a young person? I mean, it's very clear from your book the way in which you are dealing with it now, but what was it like to grow up with this? And what was it like, for instance, for your family to try and help you contend with all of the ways in which this altered the script that they probably and you probably had dreamt of for yourself?
Well, you know what? I don't know if you can say dreamt of it for myself, maybe for my parents, but not for me, because it's all that I've ever known. So it's a matter of just dealing with what life has thrown at me and just, like I said in the beginning of the book, just living large every day and just not letting anything get in my way. You know, I think that you have two decisions in life. One is to be happy and live your life, or the other is, if you know, to be miserable. And I really chose a life that I wanted to live, and I wanted to live in it very happy.
Hmm. And were you able to come to that decision and embrace that early in life, or at what point did that become clear to you?
I mean, I think it was always clear to me, especially, you know, because I have such wonderful parents that really just embedded in me that, you know, they were happy, I was going to be happy, and that it was, you know, it was just a way of life. You know, I was their first child, so they didn't know any better either. So it was kind of like we grew into this together. You know, obviously I grew in it from them, because they taught me everything. They taught me how to be an independent woman. They taught me how to never give up, how to just fight for everything that you want. So it was, like I said, it was something that we grew into together, because my parents were, you know, just in their upper 20s when I was born.
Right.
So and they didn't know any better. They didn't know from having any other children what it was like.
By the way, did they go on to have other children? Do you
they
have
did.
Siblings?
I have two other siblings, two girls.
Okay. And together you made your way through this. one of my favorite lines in the book comes towards the end of the introduction, when you say, while my physical growth has been stunted, it has been an ironic catalyst for my ability to flourish.
Yeah.
And I love irony.
Yes. I mean, this entire book, I mean, Unstoppable and Still is irony. It's such a great, and it's really, you know, the book is all about a metaphor, really. You know, the shoes are a metaphor for my life. There's tons of irony in it. It's just really, it's a fun book. It teaches you. It inspires you. It just, I think that the book, after reading it, just makes you want to be a better person. And it allows you to see that there are things in your life that you should just kind of oversee, because there are so many worse things, and then there are so many better things in life, too.
We are talking with Lauren Rutolo. Her book is called Unstoppable Stilettos, A Girl's Guide to Living Tall in a Small World. Maybe we should say a word about those stiletto shoes that are so prominently featured on the cover of the book. And actually, it's a graphic that also recurs throughout the book as well. And maybe explain to our listeners why, speaking of irony, it's an ironic image for you to be using, and why it's so uncommon for someone in your situation to be wearing stiletto heels.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's, you know, as I talk about the book and as I meet tons of men and women around the country, you know, I find out that less and less women do wear stilettos. And so I think the fact that I absolutely adore them, they make me feel good about themselves. But I think that, just going back to your original question, the reason that I do wear them, it's kind of the same reason that I'm not in a wheelchair today. I made a decision. You know, doctors and everyone in your life want you to take that safe route. Well, I never took that safe route in my life. I didn't believe in it. So, you know, one thing, if they told me, okay, if you're not going to sit in a wheelchair and you want to walk and you want to do all these things, then you need to take extra precaution. And you need to wear sneakers or orthopedic shoes, because I have a 2.5 inch discrepancy between the left and the right foot. And so that just was not in the cards for me. I grew up in a very fashionable house. Both my parents are beauticians. They own an amazing beauty salon in Long Island. And it just was not the way that I was going to go. And so by the time, you know, when I was a teenager, it's all I wanted to wear. But I had such a small foot. Well, I still have such a small foot. I wear a size 4, which is almost impossible to find. There are a few designers here and there that make it. So it was just another thing that I wanted to overcome. And actually, ever since I've been wearing heels, I feel better about myself. It's just another, like, mountain that I've climbed. And that's really how I feel about it.
Someplace it says in the book that you were essentially told you would be spending your life in a wheelchair.
That is correct.
Can you explain to us, I think I'm asking a question that might possibly be a complicated answer, but how is it that you are not in a wheelchair? I mean, are there specific sort of medical reasons why you are able to live successfully outside of a wheelchair? Or are we just talking mostly about your determination not to be in a wheelchair?
Well, I think that it's a combination of the two. There's definitely a medical reason for it, but I would say it would be like 10% medical reason and 90% determination not to be in a wheelchair. Like I said before, that the disease affects my skeletal system. So what happens is that I don't make regular bone, I make cysts. And those cysts are filled with blood, and until they harden, they are very, very soft. So what would happen is that as I would get older and I would gain more weight, just, you know, not being overweight, but just, you know, gaining more weight. As you grow, you gain more weight. My bones just really could not hold up my weight anymore. So what would happen is that they would deteriorate and they would break. So what we found out, you know, through research is that I needed to increase my muscle mass tremendously and just really strengthen my muscles in order to hold up my bones. And that's what I did. You know, I started physical therapy at the age of 4 years old. At the age of 5, I made a decision with my physical therapist and my parents that I was not going to be in a wheelchair. And I had an hour of physical therapy every single day, probably up until I was 18 years old. And now I do it about 3 to 4 days a week. So it was really, it was a marathon. I was training for that marathon, except that marathon wasn't just going to be one day. It was for the rest of my life.
One experience you had, I believe, as a that seems to have made some difference. I mean, one of the things that you especially enjoyed was singing. And pursuing a dream to be a singer, which isn't exactly working out. But I wonder, I happen to be a voice teacher, so that really jumped out at me when I saw that mentioned in the book. But I wonder if you could just say a word about what that meant to you at the time, this dream
what
of being
meant
yeah,
to be?
Yeah, singing, and this dream of being a singer also.
Well, I think that, you know, I was always a very creative, and I always just loved these different creative outlets, and I was always just inspired by music. You know, in physical therapy, I had to have music playing in order to get me going, even at such a young age. You know, whether it be in the beginning, Disney, to today, it could be, you know, Kesha or Beyonce. But it was just always a matter of that singing just made me happy, and being around, you know, music just made me happy. So I just, you know, I thought that I was this big singer, and I was going to sing, and I sang, you know, anyone that would listen to me, and I would sing in therapy, and I would sing in the car, and I would sing in my room, and so I just thought that I was this big, fabulous singer, and no one ever told me, because my parents, I guess, didn't want to make me feel bad. But not that I'm terrible, but I am no Whitney Houston by any means. And what I did was, ultimately, I just channeled my passion for music and entertainment and, you know, created a job that is just perfect for me today. So, you know, even though the singing didn't work out, another level of entertainment business worked out for me.
Hmm. In that same chapter, which is about not taking no for an answer, you tell a really amazing story about being a junior counselor at a camp.
Yes.
And then a really crushing blow that comes your way, which you tell us was the first time in your life that you really truly felt handicapped.
Yes,
I wonder if
absolutely.
You would tell our listeners this really incredible story.
Yeah, sure. So I started a day camp in my neighborhood or in the town that I grew up in. And I started at the age of 6. It was a summer that I just turned 5 years old, so it was that same summer that I decided that I was going to walk. And I went there till I was 15, going on 16 years old. And, you know, always had a wonderful summer. And then just like the natural progression of camp, they allow you to, like, come back as counselors. So that one summer that they allowed me to come back, they did not pay me. And I actually we had to pay a little something, but ultimately, there was no payment, and I would just get tips from, you know, from the kids at the end of the summer. And, you know, just going to that camp and really just growing up in that camp and growing up with the family that owned it, all of a sudden, when it came time for them to hire me, just like they hired my other camp, you know, my other camp friends, because they always like to hire counselors who were campers. And as soon as we were ready to do that, they just told me that they could not hire me because I could not carry the camper's lunch nor the camper's towels for swim. And that was probably the first sign in my life that somebody, you know, that was not a family member or a doctor or somebody that were really close to me told me that I couldn't do something or that they couldn't, couldn't be with them because of something, and that really affected me. And it was the beginning of, you know, me really understanding the handicap and really understanding the limitations that people have to understand it or that want to understand it, and that they're really afraid. You know, it was fine when my parents were paying for me to go there and they had no objections to anything, but all of a sudden everything was turned, and they wanted to, you know, at that point it was time for them to hire me, and they just were not going to have a handicapped person on their staff, which is ultimately what happened.
Mm.
You know, all of a sudden I wasn't good enough for them.
Yeah.
So when they were taking my money, I was perfect, and when they took it for, you know, 11 years, I was fine.
Well, you took some potent lessons away from that, and of course,
yes,
didn't let it stop you, particularly
no.
in what had to have been the frustrating pursuit of your first really big job. In the chapter called "Pay Your Dues," you tell us,
oh, I did.
Yeah, you tell us that in wanting to find a great job in which you could use your communications degree, you had 31 interviews before finally landing a job in a PR firm. I wonder if you could tell us about those previous interviews and that really arduous process, which, of course, nowadays is sadly not all that uncommon. But nevertheless, yeah. it had to be a really tough gauntlet that you were traveling there. What did you take away from that?
What I took away from, and let me just explain to your listeners what happened. We were not, you know, this was back in 1998, so we were not living in a recession by any means. I came out of college with a degree in communications with 5 amazing internships under my belt within the entertainment industry, you know, some big radio stations, some big television stations. And, you know, everyone was just like, oh, my God, you're going to get a job immediately. You have such great experience. Even, like, the people that I was interning for, they were like, we don't have any jobs, but if we did, we would hire you in a second. Well, it didn't really turn out like that. I kept on going out on interview after interview after interview when all my friends were getting jobs. It was at that point where it was much easier to get a job than it is today. And so people were getting jobs, you know, left and right. And here I was, one of the only people that had all this amazing experience within the industry that they wanted to be in. And no one was hiring me. And one day I really figured it out when I was on a second interview. And the hiring manager just said to me, I just have to ask because I'm not really sure. You know, do you need special insurance? Are there any special needs that you would need, that you have? Because I'm not really prepped in, you know, what happens. And that was when I knew why I wasn't getting a job. And, you know, that night I went home to my parents, as I explained in the book, and I just cried, and my parents just looked me in the eye, and they just said, you know, Lauren, someone is going to hire you, have amazing experience, and, you know, just moving forward, you know, just look them in the eye, and they're going to know that you're going to do a great job. And, you know, I find that throughout life, what I say is, yes, the first 5 minutes, you're going to be all about the handicap. But in that 6 minutes, then you're going to get to know me, and that handicap is going to go away immediately. And I think that, you know, it's like they didn't look at the experience that I had at the level that I was coming in. And you know what? I wasn't even asking for, like, a director. I was asking for an assistant job. It wasn't like, you know, I was going in there. I was looking for an entry-level job, and it just really, once that question happened, it just really, you know, made me think twice about why I wasn't getting a job and everybody else was.
You ultimately do get hired by this very fine PR firm, and you call your year and a half there or a couple of years there like getting a master's degree.
It was definitely getting a master's degree in public relations. It would... If it was a class, like I said, it would have been getting my master's. It was such a wonderful experience, and, you know, that's what I want to tell everybody and all your listeners out there is that in the beginning, I did not think that this was the ultimate job that I wanted. As a matter of fact, it wasn't, you know, it was an entertainment, but it wasn't as the entertainment that I pictured myself in when I painted that picture of what my first job would be. But it actually turned out to be the greatest job I've ever had, even to this day, because I learned more than I ever learned anywhere else. They allowed me to be independent. They allowed me to do such amazing things that it was really the 31 interviews. But the 31 interview, it became like the best gift that I ever had.
And you go on to say later in this chapter that when it comes to paying dues, it often feels like one is just kind of jumping through, in your words, jumping through nonsensical hoops. But you say you can always pick up knowledge everywhere you go, no matter what you're being asked to sort of undergo.
And
that's one of your best bits of advice in this book. We just have a couple of minutes left, and you have actually 8 major sections of the book where you share some of your thoughts that you have learned along the way. Why don't you choose a couple of your favorites?
A couple of my favorites. Oh, God, there's so many great things. I think that one of the greatest things that I talk about in the book is, and I think that we all see this throughout life, is we call them the special kind of stupid people. And I don't know if you got a chance to read that section, but it's really fantastic. And it really just talks about how the average person today does not have an edit button. And especially when they're seeing somebody like me, you know, who is 4'2", that walks with crutches, and she walks with crutches and stilettos, so I definitely stand out. And, you know, even if I'm, like, in a cab, remember I live in New York City, so I'm in and out of cabs all the time, or in the subway, or, what, you know, no matter where I am, people are, and I don't believe, and I talk about in the book, that they want to be mean, but they really just truly have no edit button in their life. So they just say outlandish things to me. And that's just a lot of, you know, the great things that that I talk about in the book. You know, just take it as a compliment, laugh it off. I call myself sometimes a moron magnet, where just the morons just want to come and talk to me all the time. But it's, you know, if you think about it, it's really funny. Mm. And you can't, that it's so funny that you can't let it hurt.
Absolutely. You also talk about, in what I, and here I am cutting you off.
No,
so you
not at all.
But I just don't want to, I don't want our time to end without you touching on the, what's really my favorite chapter in the book, chapter 7, Unforgettable. And the lesson you tell us is being different is a gift and an asset. And this was the moment in the book when I thought to myself that not only would a lot of adults profit from reading your book, but that is a message that is so important for young people to hear. And I almost get the feeling that the way you go about telling the story, this is a lesson you want to have connect with a wide range of readers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, being like you amazingly said before, being different is a gift and an asset, and that is something that I've learned along the way. You know, how I say here, you know, the definition of unforgettable is impossible to forget, indelibly impress on the memory. And after I, you know, after I just really thought about that, I'm always the one that, you know, everyone always remembers me. I've always been that little girl with a big voice, as I talk about so much within this chapter. And just be, you know, allow yourself, be unique, be unique on the outside as you are on the inside. And I think that that's really important. You know, I talk about how my disease has stunted my growth, but it did not stunt my outlook on life. And it did not stunt the way that people always say that I am unforgettable. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot, I talk a lot about, you know, about how I believe that one of the greatest assets and why people beyond just my physical appearance, which they will always remember, but they'll always, you know, the second thing that they are going to remember is that I am bold and that I take chances. Mm. And this whole book is about how I've taken those chances and how those chances have led me to be unforgettable. To, you know, to know my, from to celebrities, to people that I just meet in the street one day, and then 5 years later I'll see them again. So that's really what I talk about within that chapter. And then of course I give you the top 10 things that I find unforgettable when meeting somebody, and how, you know, how you can take those and become unforgettable. And I think that that's also really important, as we said, for teens, but also for that first, for when you're getting a job. You know, is allow people to see something that's unforgettable about you.
Absolutely. Things like confidence but not cockiness.
Exactly.
Or paying attention and asking questions. And, mm-hmm. and the 10th on that really great list, refusing to be anyone but yourself.
That is correct.
The book is Unstoppable in Stilettos, A Girl's Guide to Living Tall in a Small World, published by Health Communications Incorporated, and the author, Lauren Rutolo. Lauren Rutolo, I have enjoyed this and thoroughly enjoyed your book. Thank you so much for both.
Well, thank you so much. Have a wonderful day, and good morning to everybody again.
The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Mostly cloudy skies today and a very mild day with a high temperature today of just 70 degrees. Clear skies tonight with a low of 55 degrees. Sunny tomorrow and a high of 73. Thursday sunny, high of 76 degrees. Mostly sunny Friday, high of 78 degrees. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.